Hey, thanks so much for listening to Up First. Before we get started with today's show, though, we have a big favor to ask. Yeah, it's not that big, it's little. We'd like to better understand who you are, who is listening, and how you're using podcasts. So help us out by completing a short anonymous survey at npr.org/podcast survey, all one word. It doesn't take that much time, just less than 10 minutes, and it really helps support the show. So tell us what you think about what we do and how we do it. You can find the survey at npr.org/podcast survey. Thanks so much.
Did you know Carly Rae Jepsen is coming here to talk to us about her new album soon? Am I excited?
Call me maybe.
Uh-huh.
But come on, call me maybe.
Can we run around the office and just sing that song with you?
Hey, I just met you, and this is crazy, but here's my number, so call me maybe, and it's hard to look back.
It'll never get old.
Never, never.
Ever.
President Trump surprised many in 2016 when he did this.
Donald Trump will carry the state of Wisconsin. He's cracked the so-called blue wall that Hillary Clinton had tried to create.
So how are 2020 Democrats planning to build that wall back up again?
I'm Rachel Martin with David Greene, and this is Up First from NPR News. Three historically black churches burned in Louisiana over the course of 10 days.
Not only did we have a serious public safety threat, but we had an attack on our God and our religion.
A 21-year-old man is now in custody, charged with arson. What effect is this having on the community?
And Omar al-Bashir has ruled Sudan, often callously, for 3 decades. After months of protests, he's been ousted in a coup. But with the military now in charge, is there any hope for a transition to democracy? Stay with us. We have the news you need to start your day. So what happens now that the wall has come down? It's a question on the mind of Game of Thrones fans, of course, but also Democratic presidential candidates.
Yeah, for the Democrats, it is the so-called blue wall. This is a term used by political scientists to refer to this cluster of eastern, western, and midwestern states that have consistently gone blue in recent presidential elections. But in 2016, this happened.
There's a big old call to make right now, and that is Fox News is projecting that Donald Trump has won the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you to the incredible people of Michigan.
Some big news here, Megan. Huge news. Actually, the AP now projecting that Donald Trump has won the state of Pennsylvania.
So how are 2020 Democratic hopefuls trying to figure out how to win those states back?
Well, let's ask NPR political correspondent Scott Detrow, who is covering the run-up to 2020. Hi there, Scott.
Good morning, David.
Well, let's start with Bernie Sanders. I mean, it sounds like he is one of the candidates who, is really crafting a lot of his messaging on the idea that he can win these states back, right?
Yeah, I think Democrats have more hope than, you know, maybe the north of Westeros in terms of rebuilding this wall. all the campaigns are confident that Democrats can win these states again, and that's part of the conversation. There's been this interesting shift where a lot of Democratic voters are really focused on electability, who can best beat Trump, issues aside. Bernie Sanders is near the top of most of the polls. His campaign realizes still, though, that he needs to make this case that he is the best person to beat Trump. I talked to his campaign manager, Faz Shakir, and he is arguing that Trump won those states by sounding very Bernie Sanders-like.
He offered a bunch of rhetoric that I think was stolen right out of Bernie Sanders' language. He talked about draining the swamp, about saving Medicare and Social Security, about cutting fair trade deals.
So that's an argument Sanders is going to be making as he becomes just the latest Democrat to spend time campaigning in these states, even though, of course, none of them are in that early wave of primary states.
Right, but still important. But that makes me want to ask you how important. Like, are they obsessed with the blue wall and really feel like it all comes down to this?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. It is dangerous to talk confidently about an election so far away, but if you look at how narrowly Trump won these states, just tens of thousands of votes, I think that most people agree that these are the states that are going to decide 2020. And again, with so many voters saying, how can you beat Trump? Tell me your political strategy here. You're seeing candidates focus on that. Beto O'Rourke and Amy Klobuchar both visited some of these states in the very first days of their campaign. Kirsten Gillibrand's been to Michigan as well. Sanders is doing this swing. I think this is going to be a big theme going forward.
And Scott, the narrative that kind of took hold was that white rural voters were really critical. I mean, they voted for Trump and the Democrats need to win them over to take these states back. Is that what your reporting shows or is it more complicated?
I think it's a lot more complicated. Think about the fact that if Milwaukee and Detroit voters had been just a little bit more enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton, just the tiniest bit more enthusiastic and voted, she very likely would be president. And this is something that Milwaukee Democratic Congresswoman Gwen Moore is trying to remind candidates of.
You can't put all your money into trying to make sure that rural folks get your vote. African Americans are just like any other voters. They need to be dealt in to the game. They need to feel like there is something that they can gain from it as well.
So black voters are a key part of any Democratic coalition in these states, especially over the rest of the country, of course. So far, Moore says that she's very happy about what she's hearing. Sanders and other candidates talking a lot about criminal justice reform, voting rights, other things that many African American voters really care deeply about.
And briefly, I mean, Republicans, I just feel like let's repeat what we did in 2016 to get those states.
That and an increased focus on socialism, warning the Democratic Party is drifting far to the left.
NPR political correspondent Scott Detrow. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to turn now to Louisiana, where in the course of 10 days, three historically black churches were destroyed by fire.
Yeah, these churches are in St. Landry Parish. This is about 60 miles west of Baton Rouge. They had been standing for generations. The fires, though, have destroyed them completely. Investigators are now trying to figure out what happened. And yesterday, there was a breakthrough in the investigation. Police arrested a 21-year-old white man named Holden Matthews, who happens to be the son of a local sheriff's deputy. Matthews has been charged with three counts of arson. Louisiana's Governor John Bel Edwards talked after the arrest.
I don't know what this young man's motive was. I don't know what was in his heart, but I can say it cannot be justified or rationalized. These were evil acts.
All right, I want to bring in Katie Gugliano. She's been reporting this story for the Acadiana Advocate. Good morning, Katie.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for taking the time to bring us your reporting. So who is this man, Holden Matthews, and what might have been his motive here?
Yeah, so Holden Matthews is a 21-year-old from Opelousas, Louisiana. That's the area where these fires occurred. As you said, his father, Roy Matthews, is a sheriff's deputy for St. Landry Parish. We know that his father actually assisted in facilitating his arrest. We don't know too much about him. We're still discovering things. We know that the sheriff said he doesn't have a reported history of violence or an arrest record. We've also discovered, as I said in a press conference yesterday, he has connections to paganism and beliefs in Norse mythology. Now, some of these offshoots can have some connections to neo-Nazi movements or white supremacy. It's still undetermined if he was involved in any of those subsets.
Okay, so we're just learning more about this young man.
Yes.
Can you talk about these churches and how important they've been in this community?
These churches are very central to the lives of the people that live in this area. Religion and faith are a cornerstone. As you said, these churches have been in the communities for generations. Congregants that I spoke to said their families have been there for years. Many of them have celebrated all of their religious rites in these churches. They've been christened, they've been baptized, they've been married there. They said seeing these churches burn, though losing a building can destroy their faith, it's still a very heavy emotional and sentimental loss for them.
Well, I just want to listen to the voice here of a pastor at one of the churches, Reverend Gerald Toussaint. Here he is.
A lot of people want to make it a hate thing. Well, we don't represent hate. No. We represent love.
Is that the sentiment that the leaders of these churches are basically expressing right now?
Yes, and that's what they've really been expressing from the beginning. You know, as you heard the governor say, hate doesn't have a place here, and that's really what these pastors have been leading with. They've been wanting to keep the focus on the endurance of their faith, the importance of love, and spreading that message. You know, we're still trying to determine, as you said, what the motives are in this case. And, of course, given the nature of these fires, they are looking at this as, you know, a potentially bias-motivated event. But until they determine that, the pastors are wanting to keep their communities calm and keep the focus on facts.
Katie Gagliano with the Acadiana Advocate. Thanks a lot.
Of course. Thank you.
A And so on Thursday morning, Sudan awoke to word from the state news broadcaster that the military would be making an important announcement.
Later came a declaration from Sudan's defense minister. The defense minister announced that longtime President Omar Hassan al-Bashir, who has led that country for 30 years, had been arrested and removed from office. It was the news protesters had been waiting for. Thousands were on the streets celebrating. But the joy was short-lived after the defense minister said he would oversee a transitional government, not what protesters had wanted to hear.
NPR's Afebia Quist-Arton has been following these developments. Hi, Afebia.
Greetings.
So, I mean, al-Bashir has been known for so long as just a ruthless African tyrant. Does that pretty much capture his reign over these 30 years, or is it more complicated?
It is a little more complicated. He is a political survivor. He came in 30 years ago. He was a military officer, a senior military officer, but his political opponents and his critics say that he has overseen Sudan, which was one of the biggest countries in Africa and should have been one of the richest, had oil, had a southern part. He has overseen a war with the South, which has now become an independent country, economic mismanagement, and of course, Darfur, and the, quotes, genocide, as Colin Powell called it. So Bashir is seen as somebody who's been a political maneuverer and operator, but somebody who has not done well for his country.
Well, as Rachel mentioned, I mean, protesters wanted him out. It seems like they've gotten that, but they did not want the military in charge of their country for the foreseeable future. So how is the protest movement feeling at this moment?
You know, initially there was joy and jubilation on the streets, but it's been a bittersweet moment because, you know, the protesters have been on the streets since December demanding that Bashir must go, and he's gone. And then who do they find has taken over? The same military that has supported Bashir for decades. The defense minister is Omar al-Bashir's lieutenant. So there is deep skepticism and anger. Listen, for example, to Dalia Arubi. She's a prominent opposition activist. She's one of the people who's been organizing these protests. She says, absolutely not. We do not want a military takeover and a military administration. We want civilian government in Sudan.
It's completely unacceptable. It's the assumption that people will actually believe that this is not another face of the NCP is really quite insulting. And they're underestimating the knowledge and awareness and commitment of the people in the street and their convictions for change.
You know, Arubi says the former governing NCP is not going to take over again in Sudan. And that's what many people believe. They also say maybe ousted president Bashir, is he ousted or is he the one who is fiddling with the strings behind the scenes?
Well, what is next for al-Bashir? I mean, he's still wanted by the International Criminal Court on charges of war crimes and genocide, right?
Indeed. And the people who are now in charge are the people who have backed him. So many Sudanese feel, although Bashir should go to The Hague and face these charges for crimes against humanity in Darfur, that it won't happen because there is the same clique that is in power. And he is such a political survivor. Who knows what will happen? But there's a big question mark hanging over the future of Omar Hassan al-Bashir.
NPR's Afebia Quist-Arton. Thanks so much, Afebia.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
And that is up first for Friday, April 12th. I'm David Green.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Our producer is Bo Hamby. Our editors are Eric McDaniel and William Jones. Our music is composed by Nick Dupre and Louis Weeks. Kenya Young is the executive producer of Up First. Come back Monday. We'll be here. And because the news doesn't stop when this podcast ends, follow us on Twitter at Up First for your daily roundup of the most important stories of the day.
And we want to remind you, please, please, please never forget this. Up First is here every morning because of your NPR station. Your financial support lets us do more things like this very show. Support your NPR station right now by going to donate.npr.org. And here's some advice. Start your weekend with NPR's Weekend Edition. You can find it tomorrow morning on your local station. And if you need to find that station, just visit stations.npr.org. Have a great weekend.
Hey, y'all. I'm Sam Sanders. I host an NPR show called It's Been a Minute. Every Friday on the show, I talk out the week of news. Because sometimes the best way to process everything going on right now is through good conversation. download the show, and we'll process everything together.